Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. This week we start the holiday season. We're trying to balance health, nutrition, and enjoyment, maybe its own kind of stress for many. So I'd like to start the show with an opinion piece from one of my favorite people, Dr. David Katz, who's a big person in prevention. And here is an article he wrote called What Health Is For. All too readily in my world, health can masquerade as a moral imperative, the admonishment attached to a wagging finger and reproaching scowl. While there may be responsibilities wound up with health for ourselves and one another, the main reason to pursue it is far more enticing. Other things being equal, healthy people have more fun. Health is for pleasure. This is perhaps especially noteworthy as the holiday season, with its inevitable blend of temptation, indulgence, and guilt closes in on us. Health is for pleasure. The only real problem with that otherwise quite valid assertion is the potential for profligacy and excess. All pleasure must respect the limits of propriety and autonomy. So, for instance, perhaps it pleases me to swing a stick. My right to do so ends where your nose begins. All respectable pleasure honors such boundaries. Perhaps, then, we might apply a related term, less prone to slippage on a slope towards decadence, quality of life. Health is for maximizing the quality of life. This term offers many advantages while preserving the main theorem. The quality of your life is informed by many factors, including pleasure, but perhaps others even more importantly, fulfillment, gratification, satisfaction, pride. These all borrow from pleasure and contribute to it as well, but are all distinct. Quality of life also passes the filter for medical legitimacy, having evolved into a term of that trade and a valid measure of outcome. More often than not, quality and time are commingled into quality-adjusted life years. My routine user-friendly reworking for this is years in life and life in years. Vitality conjoined with longevity. Health fosters both by these and any other words. This is more important than it seems and directly relevant as you look for some balance between doing what you want to do and doing what you think you should do. Should you eat or resist that dessert? Have or decline that mulled wine? Take or decline that hors d'oeuvre making the rounds? When health is relegated to the abrasive realm of moral imperatives, these and many other holiday temptations, and for that matter temptations year-round, are choices between what's right and what's fun. But if within reason maximizing fun is what doing what's right is for, it changes the equation. More and more evidence favors the powerful health-promoting effects of fairly modest but consistent commitments. The evidence that sitting is harmful points towards a simple, potent, and for most of us quite easy remedy: stand, stretch, and walk around briefly throughout your standard day. Recent evidence shows that running in even very modest doses is a potent defense against premature death. Don't despair if disinclined to run. Evidence suggests that just walking, exercise readily accessible to most of us, confers powerful health benefits. As for eating, the weight of evidence regarding weight and every other outcome of importance is comparably encouraging. Despite an obscuring fog of boisterous bickering, there's no one diet that you must adopt to profit your well-being. There are many variants, albeit on a common theme, that empower all of us to love the foods that love us back. shop your options with that goal in mind. There is no magical combination of foods you must maintain your weight. The latest and best evidence on that topic indicates, clearly and emphatically, that calories count above all. Don't count them. That's very tedious, but acknowledge their imperium by doing what you can to favor wholesome and simple foods, free of willful manipulation, while avoiding ultra-processed foods. Among the many virtues of the former, they fill us up on many fewer calories than the latter. While the pop culture narrative about intermittent fasting is inevitably hyperbolic, implying some metabolic magic the research fails to reveal, there is a happy takeaway from this tale nonetheless. Fasting periodically works as well for weight control as daily restraint, and thus provides an alternative tactic. The tactic that works best for you are those that work best for you, so options are a very good thing. Blended, these and related tidbits of evidence and ingredients of argument come together in a rather lovely recipe. Almost all exercise is good exercise, and you will support your health just by making some movement part of your routine. The more the better for health generally, but maybe not for net pleasure and quality of life. Some of us love exercise, I do, but some don't. Across the spectrum from love it to hate it, the optimal dose, intensity, and frequency that leads to the greatest net pleasure and quality of life will vary. Only you can choose your sweet spot. You're the boss. So too for food. An inveterate foodie is perhaps apt to be happier, truly happier, with culinary latitude and somewhat larger waist to show for it. Conversely, a health and fitness fanatic would almost certainly favor more dietary asceticism in the service of stronger, faster, fitter, leaner. If the formula that maximizes quality of life varies with our dispositions and character, it is no health professional's place to impose a one-size-fits-all decree. My whole career is about optimizing health, so of course I think it is important, but I recognize that health per se is not the prize. The prize is having the best possible life, and health matters so much because of the contributors it makes to that measure, but the pursuit of health can at times compete with other sources of pleasure, fulfillment, and fun. And at those times, there is a balance to be struck. The holidays are, quintessentially, such a time. My advice is guilt-free holiday pleasure and a year-round commitment to health by the means that work best for you as one among your priorities. Not because someone says you should, just because, other things being equal, healthy people really do have more fun. I like this because it really gets at the somewhat false dichotomy between nutrition and taste and enjoyment, and that there's a balance to be struck there. First, many people don't actually pay much attention to what they eat much of the time. And I would offer today's somewhat odd tip. If you're not going to pay much attention to your eating experience, why not eat healthy foods where the primary attribute may not be taste? Although, I would say, alas, I want you to enjoy your total eating experience. So I want to share just a little bit on mindfulness, or sometimes it's even called slow eating. Here's some tips. Most people live very busy lives and have many ingrained habits and practices that make it difficult to pay full and proper attention to your food. Nonetheless, with practice, you can train yourself to better enjoy and better control your eating. First, minimize the distractions in your environment, so you can focus on the taste, smells, textures, temperatures, and colors of your food. Don't eat while driving. Turn off the TV. If silence is too much for you or people around you, try a few minutes of silence at a time or listen to some soothing music. Sit at a table. Put your food on a plate, maybe rather than eating from a bag or a box. Saying a prayer of thanks or meditating on gratitude for having your food may help create a positive perspective. Take your first bite with your eyes closed. Most of your mental activity is associated with vision. Closing your eyes frees up more mental energy and focus for your eating experiences. Dimming the lights can help as well. Chew your food slowly for 20 bites, savoring between every bite. Feeding yourself with your non-dominant hand is a good way to force yourself to pay attention to what you are doing. You may want to eat everything with chopsticks for a week to kick off your mindful eating practices. Sip your drink between bites and throughout your meal. If you are eating with others, share your eating experiences with each other. Better yet, if they are up for mindful eating as well. You can extend and expand your mindful eating habits to cooking for a more complete mealtime experience. If your quest is for the total food experience, incorporate the planting, growing, harvesting, and buying food experiences as well. How you eat can be as rewarding to your quality of life as what you eat. And my wish for you this holiday season is may you find much pleasure and quality of life. Okay, well, let's move on. I wanted to start off with another kind of long piece. This is from Stat News, and this is from, let me see, I'll cite who it's from. This is from Joshua Sharfstein, MD, who's a professor of the practice in the Department of Health Policy and Management at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health and author of the Public Health Crisis Survival Guide, Leadership and Management in Trying Times. And what he's writing about here, I thought he does a rather adept view of kind of a case study in public health entitled, Why the FDA Was Unable to Prevent a Crisis of Vaping Among Kids. When it comes to the public's health, it always seems to take a crisis before protections are put in place. The Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938, the bedrock law that first required companies to conduct safety studies of medications before they could be sold, was passed only after a tainted drug killed scores of children. In 1962, a scare over birth defects caused by thalidomide led to groundbreaking standards for clinical trials. Medical device controls, enacted in 1976 after the Dalkon Shield caused infertility and infections in thousands of women. Food safety legislation, it received bipartisan support only after the recall of 500 million eggs tainted by salmonella. My public health students often ask an obvious question. Why is it so challenging for regulatory agencies to prevent calamities in the first place? In years past, I have struggled with a concise answer to this question, until now. Now I tell them to examine why the Food and Drug Administration was unable to keep millions of youths from becoming addicted to electronic cigarettes, how the agency wound up taking much of the blame for hundreds of people with severe lung injuries, and why long overdue action to protect the public still remains out of reach. Lesson 1. Imminent economic harms beats the threat of injury to the public. The story starts in September 2008, during the administration of President George W. Bush. The FDA detained early batches of e-cigarettes on the grounds that they appeared to be unapproved medical devices designed to deliver the drug nicotine. The manufacturers quickly took the agency to court, arguing that their products were neither devices nor drugs. Instead, they claimed that e-cigarettes were most akin to traditional cigarettes, which the Supreme Court had recently said the FDA could not regulate without new legislation from Congress. The company sought an injunction against the FDA on the grounds that the agency was causing them immediate and irreversible economic harm. The FDA's response was, in essence, that e-cigarettes barely resemble cigarettes and look a lot more like nicotine inhalers, which are regulated devices that contain drugs. As the case was pending, FDA released early data revealing the presence of harmful chemicals in e-cigarettes. The agency also held a press conference and warned the public of the risks of addiction and lung injury. I remember this moment well because at the time I served as principal deputy commissioner of the FDA. We're concerned about them because of what we know is in them and what we don't know about how they affect the human body, I told the New York Times then. The FDA's efforts didn't help. District Court Judge Richard Leon issued a restraining order against the FDA to prevent, quote, irreparable harm to the e-cigarette industry, criticizing the agency for its, quote, for its tenacious drive to maximize its regulatory power. I am not convinced that the threat to the public interest in general or to third parties in particular is as great as FDA suggests. On to lesson 2, courts show little deference to public health agencies. The FDA appealed the district court decision, arguing that Leon had given extraordinarily little weight to public health concerns. Supporting the agency's position, the American Lung Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Cancer Society, and other health authorities wrote a friend of the court brief. These organizations argued that the district court decision could result in increases in tobacco use, especially among children, by introducing non-smokers to smoking behaviors and nicotine through the use of unregulated products like electronic cigarettes. Their brief also noted that without quick FDA action, e-cigarettes could be manufactured and marketed in a way that appealed to children, e.g., by using flavors that appeal to children. These fears would later be proven true. But the industry stuck to its position that economic damage outweighed these, quote, conjectural and speculative health benefits of regulation. At the appeals court, the FDA made a special effort to point out that regulation did not mean the end of the e-cigarette industry. The agency would not be forced to remove all products from the market. Rather, the agency could leave e-cigarettes on the market, quote, while the new applications were prepared, provided certain time frames and other specific conditions were met. In other words, the FDA could allow companies to sell e-cigarettes as the agency phased in manufacturing standards, restrictions on flavors, and other standards. The agency's view was then, as it is now, the regulation should balance the potential benefits of these products to smokers looking to quit against the risks of new nicotine addiction among youth. But its efforts failed. In December 2010, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals again sided with the tobacco industry, refusing to grant deference to the agency's position that its authority to regulate drugs and medical devices was the most appropriate path for regulating these products. By this time, a new law gave the FDA authority over tobacco products that passed Congress. The court required the agency to use the new Tobacco Control Act to oversee e-cigarettes and related devices that allow the user to, quote, vape. But this law required years of rulemaking before the FDA could impose any restrictions. And during this period, the industry was able to grow rapidly. Lesson 3. Growing industries wield political power. In 2011, the year I left the FDA, the agency began the arduous process of addressing vaping under the Tobacco Control Act. This process required calls for public comment, economic and regulatory analysis, and reviews by multiple offices in the Department of Health and Human Services and the White House. It would be 3 more years before the FDA was ready to start regulating e-cigarettes. The first proposal was published in April 2014. Among other topics, the agency sought public comment about the availability of flavored e-cigarette liquids and the possibility that these flavors could appeal to youth. Within about a year, as the Los Angeles Times reported, the FDA had determined that 4 of 5 youth who vaped cited flavor as a reason, and that the actual flavors were largely overlapped with those used in Kool-Aid, Jolly Ranchers, and Lifesavers. Inside the Obama administration, health officials proposed removing such flavors from these products with an effective date of November 2016. The industry fought back. This time, instead of the courts, the playing field was the White House's Office of Management and Budget, which approves major rules from agencies like the FDA. During dozens of meetings in the White House, small business owners and their lobbyists brought industry scientists to contest the FDA's findings. Lobbyists showed signs of picketers holding signs saying, "I vape, I vote." Store owners predicted an economic vapocalypse. I should note that one of the lobbyists for e-cigarette manufacturers was a former White House staffer who had reviewed the FDA's proposed rule the prior year. Industry won again. The final regulation took effect in 2016 without the flavor provisions. The regulation gave manufacturers 2 years to submit key health data or face the product's removal from the market. Early in the Trump administration, though, with a looming threat of White House or congressional action to protect the vaping industry, the FDA extended this deadline. As two administrators were trying to find a kinder and gentler path for the industry, a new company called Juul entered the market. With its teen-friendly marketing, intense flavors, and ability to deliver high levels of nicotine, Juul quickly became the dominant device in the country. As reports of rapid increases in youth vaping became public, the FDA imposed modest restrictions on sales, and the Surgeon General issued a warning to parents. But enormous damage to public health was already being done. By 2018, 3.6 million kids were vaping, representing a 78% increase in just 1 year, with more than two-thirds choosing flavored products. In 2019, the FDA found that more than 5 million youth used e-cigarettes in the past 30 days, and nearly 1 million reported daily use. The agency determined that while cigarette smoking is at an all-time low among high school students, increases in e-cigarette use have reversed progress made in the decline of overall youth tobacco use. Lesson 4. When crisis strikes, the press and public draw the wrong lessons. In the summer of 2019, the vaping crisis became a full-blown catastrophe. Alert physicians at the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin noticed a pattern of adolescents coming to the hospital struggling to breathe. Their x-rays revealed severe lung injuries. The common factor? Vaping. At a press conference on July 25th, the doctors joined state health officials to sound the alarm. Almost immediately, the medical community across the country began to report new cases. The precise cause of the outbreak remained unclear, with the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention focused on the potential role of vitamin E acetate as an additive in products, and that may also contain THC, the active chemical in marijuana. As I wrote this, CDC had counted 2,172 cases of severe lung disease across the country, with 42 deaths. Vaping injuries became front page news, with the imminent risk of injury sharing space with a new appreciation for the explosion of its use among youth. Seizing the moment of crisis, several state health officials took action, with some banning flavors in e-cigarettes and others temporarily banning their sale altogether. A major part of the news, however, became how the FDA had failed. On October 14th, New York Times headline read, "E-cigarettes went unchecked for 10 years of FDA inaction." While the headline was later changed to the more accurate phrase, "federal inaction," it's not hard to see why the first draft said FDA. For several years, many advocates had trained their criticism on the FDA for not doing more about electronic cigarettes. A few months earlier, the American Lung Association had given the agency an F for lack of action on vaping, even though the Lung Association knew, or should have known, that there was a lot more to the story. During the previous decade, the FDA had tried to protect the public, and especially youths, from the potential harms of e-cigarettes, yet the agency had been stopped by the courts, impeded by the White House, and repeatedly warned to back off by members of Congress. The fundamental problem was not that the FDA had been sitting on its hands, the problem was that its hands were tied. Shouldering the lion's share of the blame has undermined the FDA's credibility at critical points in time. In September, President Trump announced a ban on flavors for vaping products, although he didn't have a plan for implementing it. Notably, FDA officials had no role in announcing the news to the public, nor have they been able to propose and defend a more comprehensive approach to maximizing the benefits of e-cigarettes for adults who smoke while minimizing the risks to youth. As the ensuing days turned into weeks, the industry regrouped and argued yet again that the economic damage of industry outweighs the risk to public health. The news media covered the tribulations of e-cigarette retailers. It has been a rough few months around the country. Economic arguments have apparently convinced the president not to proceed with a ban on flavored e-cigarettes, at least until the next crisis strikes. Final exam? What will it take for the next time to be different? The easy answer is greater respect for scientific agencies. Individuals without scientific expertise, including judges and politicians, should not be so quick to dismiss the role of those who best understand serious risk to health and what can be done to stop them. Short of this shift, greater transparency would be a step forward. When judges restrict agency action, they should refrain from claiming that the risks are not real or could easily be prevented through alternative approaches. Instead, they should acknowledge in their decisions that harms predicted by experts may well come to pass. White House staffers should sign their names to decisions that stop the actions of FDA and other agencies that are intended to save lives. And the media should investigate the decision-making behind the scenes, just as the Washington Post has done in reporting that it was Trump's campaign manager who influenced his recent reversal on vaping. Advocates, for their part, should orient themselves to the entire government, not just a regulatory agency. It's not enough to press the FDA or another agency to take a specific action. Efforts should also be directed to political appointees and courts with the power to stop the agencies. As for the scientific agencies themselves, career regulators should keep doing their jobs, using the best available evidence to put forward reasonable, effective standards to save lives. They should beware the siren call for self-censorship and point out to elected leaders that preventable crises have often serious consequences for political popularity as well as for the health of their constituents. Why does it always seem to take a crisis? The beginning of wisdom is to look beyond the regulatory agency alone for the answer.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Now I'd like to proceed to the public health news and research roundup, where I gather up all the wonderful things in the world of public health so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
Since politically the number one concern for Americans is healthcare, I wanted to start off with a series of articles related to that, and beginning specifically off ones that relate to healthcare for all. So this from the Physicians for National Health Program. Utilization of healthcare services after large coverage expansions. Policymakers and pundits often claim that universal health coverage would cause utilization of care to spike to levels that the health system could not sustain. But recent studies of real-world coverage expansions have found no overall increase in hospitalizations or doctor visits following the implementation of Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, and even truly universal health systems in other nations. Instead of patient pileups and intolerable queues, newly insured patients with significant medical needs were finally able to receive care while doctors cut back on unnecessary care for the wealthier and healthier patients. This shift in care was driven by doctors' ability to prioritize patients based on medical need. Previously, overserved patients did not suffer from or generally even notice the difference. From the effects on hospitalization of the 1966 and 2014 health insurance coverage expansion in the United States, published July 23, 2019, in the Annals of Internal Medicine, it found that previous coverage expansion in the United States did not result in net increase of hospital use, but did redistribute care to those with the most pressing medical needs. And from the American Journal of Public Health this November, coverage expansions and utilization of physician care, evidence from the 2014 Affordable Care Act and the 1966 Medicare-Medicaid expansions. It found that the overall use of physician care did not change after the implementation of large-scale coverage expansions in the late 1960s and the mid-2010s. And from the Journal of Internal Medicine, also from just published November 20th of this year, the effect of large-scale health coverage expansions in wealthy nations on society-wide healthcare utilization. It found that coverage expansions in other wealthy nations did not lead to an increase in utilization of care. Next up, increasing costs is always a concern related to health care. And this from the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Employees spending greater share of income on health insurance in Ohio and U.S. Across the United States, the cost of health insurance and deductibles for those with employer-based plans is outpacing median income, according to a new report from the Commonwealth Fund, a private foundation that supports creating a better healthcare system. Over the last decade, employer health insurance premiums and deductibles have grown faster than workers' wages. This is concerning because it may put both coverage and healthcare out of the reach for millions of people, said Sarah Collins, the Vice President of Healthcare Coverage and Access for the Commonwealth Fund and one of the authors of the report. Rising deductibles could make employees more likely to delay or skip care or to not take prescription medications, the report said. And if premiums get too high, some might forego health insurance altogether. Nationally, the average employee premium contribution and deductible represented 11.5% of median household income in 2018, up from 7.8% a decade before. In Ohio, the average premium contribution and deductible made up 11.1% of median household income, compared to 6.9% in 2008. David Blumenthal, president of the Commonwealth Fund, said health insurance is becoming less and less affordable for the 164 million people in the U.S. who are insured through their employer. And I just want to point out, I mean, these stats are a little bit tricky. It doesn't actually seem a lot, you know, the amount of a premium contribution going up from 7.8% to 11.5%. But if you think about that as effectively a tax on employees, you're really talking about a 3.7% increase or a 3.7% quote tax on people, money that they would not otherwise have to pay if there wasn't an increase in the contributions for deductibles and co-pays. And that is, by the way, about a 50% increase in what their current share was. So that is a lot. Okay, next up from CBPP.org, Georgia waivers at least as costly to cover far fewer people than Medicaid expansion. Under two recent state proposals to waive federal Medicaid and Affordable Care Act rules, Georgia would spend at least as much to extend coverage to about 400,000 fewer people than if it just adopted the ACA's Medicaid expansion. And one waiver would likely cut rather than increase coverage. Although the state estimates that over 408,000 non-elderly, uninsured adult Georgians have incomes below the poverty line, and other estimates show most are in working families, Georgia projects that only about 50,000 people would eventually enroll in Medicaid because the rest won't be able to meet the waiver's burdensome requirements. All told, the state will spend $322 million, or about $250 million excluding costs covered by user fees, to extend coverage to just under 80,000 Georgians under the two waiver proposals, according to its own estimates, while upending its entire insurance market. In contrast, the state could spend between $188 million and $213 million to extend Medicaid coverage to 487,000 to 598,000 residents if it joins 34 other states in accepting the full ACA Medicaid expansion. While some of those gaining Medicaid would otherwise have had marketplace coverage, 473,000 Georgians would gain health insurance through the expansion, the Urban Institute estimates. That would let Georgia realize the full benefits of expanded coverage, including improved access to care and financial security for people gaining coverage, decreases in uncompensated care costs, and fewer premature deaths. Again, just to review those numbers, the state, with its burdensome, complicated, and expensive waiver proposals, wants to insure another 50,000 people at a greater cost than doing the simple full expansion, which would cost less money. Crazy times, people. We need radical reform, the whole system. Okay, this from the Columbus Dispatch. Next up, Ohio Medicaid still hemorrhaging money to pharmacy middlemen, expert testifies. A national drug pricing consultant says that despite implementing a new pricing system and other efforts to rein in pharmacy middlemen, Ohio's Medicaid program continues hemorrhaging tax dollars. The $28 billion Medicaid program in Ohio provides health insurance to nearly 3 million poor and disabled Ohioans. Currently, the state contracts with five private managed care plans to oversee the program, and they employ three pharmacy benefit managers, PBMs, CVS Caremark, RX Advance, and Optum RX. A recent study found that CVS Caremark and Optum RX billed the state $244 million more than they paid pharmacists in a single year, allowing them to profit 3 to 6 times the industry standard. Using a spread pricing model, the PBMs, the pharmacy benefit managers, billed the state far more than they paid pharmacists to fill prescriptions and kept the difference. So, just the 2 out of 3 pharmacy middlemen siphoned off about 1% of the entire cost of Ohio Medicaid in unjustified profits. Again, this free market approach to healthcare creates another, quote, tax from out of control free market healthcare. Let's not get confused about tax language. Let's understand that the total costs are much, much higher when you have this disjointed so-called free market healthcare that allows people to game the systems for massive unjust profits.
It started in Norway in 1912. and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of health care for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, I'd like to end the show today with a little bit more of an optimistic story. This from Discover Magazine. How does the brain work with half of it removed? Pretty well, actually. I might note you might have met some of these people. In severe cases of epilepsy, a patient's seizures can become so incessant and other treatments so ineffective that doctors will remove half of the brain during childhood to stop them. It's a procedure known as a hemispherectomy. Yet incredibly, these patients still have intact motor language and thinking skills. In a study published in Cell Reports, scientists studied six of these patients to see how the human brain rewires itself to adapt to other major surgery. After performing brain scans on the patients, the researchers found that the remaining hemispheres formed even stronger connections between different brain networks, regions that control things like walking, talking, and memory, than in healthy control subjects. The researchers suggest that enhanced connections show how the brain can adapt in extreme circumstances to enable cognition and consciousness, even when half of it is gone. Well, that's just a little kind of science freak note on the fact that the body is very adaptable, and we should be thankful for that. Well, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. That's wakt@toppun.com. Or if you'd like to re-listen to this show or any previous show or queue up future shows, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.